now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Under a Cold Moon is the extraordinary true story of a man that devastated two worlds. A killer that used the chump card as his cover for two brutal murders. His first victim lay under the rocks for 15 nights. His second lay under the dirt for 61. Two women, two murders, one spurned slayer. In this cool tale, the author exposes the dark secrets of a man that stalked older women. Latham weaves this story from an insider's window, a writer that was in the thick of things and interviewed the man behind these two cataclysmic homicides. The book that we're featuring this evening is Under a Cold Moon, a chronicle of an unrequited killer, with my special guest, Tony H. Latham. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Tony H. Latham.
Dan, I'm quite pleased to be here. This is an honor, a great crime podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that. Congratulations on this incredible book. Let's start off first with, as you do, right to the incredible event that happens November 7th and a call to the sheriff dispatch in North Fork.
Salmon, Idaho.
Yes.
Yeah. So the incident occurred in North Fork, Idaho, which is a tiny little burg of, you know, the census says the population of 150, but really only 10 people or so lived there at the time. Very remote country, 3 hours to the nearest Walmart, 2 hours to the nearest package of men's underwear, mm-hmm. 30 minutes to the county seat of 2,000, 3,000, nothing but Forest Service ground around there. And that morning, a guy that was 76 years old went down to where his wife ran a bar and kind of a small eatery 7 miles away from his place. And he did this every morning. He'd go down there, have coffee with her, and then he'd go do whatever he'd do that day. And then he'd come back for dinner there, spend a little time with his wife, Nancy. And they lived apart like that because she was an extrovert and ran that bar till midnight or so. And he had a lodge 7 miles away where he lived. And they had five adult kids. They had run several successful businesses. They had some money. And that morning, on the 7th of November, he got there to have breakfast and coffee with his wife. And she was missing. She was gone. And there's nothing amiss there at this place called the Rivers Fork Inn. So he calls the sheriff's office all upset. His voice was quivering and explained what was going on. And when he called the sheriff's office, people need to understand that this sheriff's office at that time and still is god-awful small. There were six patrol officers that covered the whole nine yards in a huge county the size of New Jersey. And so it was six officers from time to time. There'd normally be one deputy on board for each shift, and then the sheriff and the chief deputy. And the only people that were available that morning when Cliff called was the sheriff and the chief deputy. So they couldn't believe what they were hearing. A 74-year-old businesswoman with a family disappears into the night. So they ran up there. They get up there. There's 8 inches of fresh snow on the ground. Her car is still sitting out front with 8 inches of snow on it. And there's Cliff, one of his sons, and his brother-in-law. And they're all upset because Nancy's missing. And they look around. There's the money from the till is still there where she was counting the money that night. Her bed's kind of tussled up, but it didn't look slept in. The only thing missing was Nancy Cummings.
What was your occupation and what was your connection to this area? And as we find out to this story.
So I was an Idaho conservation officer, a game warden. And I think most of your listeners are going to understand what a game warden does, but we chase poachers. And in Idaho, game wardens have the same statutory or powers, police powers, as the Idaho State Police do. But the primary focus, of course, is on poachers, wildlife crimes.
Now, what happens in this investigation with Sheriff Brett Barcelew and Chief Deputy Sam Slavin? What's their approach? What's their next step? And who do they speak to? and very quickly, what person of interest is alerted to them?
Well, you know, initially there was just no evidence of a crime. Just suddenly this woman is missing, a type of woman, a family woman, a businesswoman that just shouldn't be missing, but no evidence of a crime. You know, there was one door that was open on the inn, unlocked. And in this tiny little town of North Fork, there's only two businesses, this Rivers Fork Inn plus the North Fork Cafe. And that's basically it. And Nancy is the only employee of the Rivers Fork Inn. So they go over to the North Fork Cafe, 150 yards away, and start talking to people. And one of the guys, one of the workers there, a guy named Harmon, said, you know, you ought to go talk to Eddie Hertel. He lives up the North Fork here. And so Sam Slavin drives up there, grabs the search and rescue member, and finds Ed Hertel. He's 29 years old. He's looks and acts a little goofy because he suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome at birth. So he had a wandering right eye and he had a stutter. And he gets defensive right off the start with those guys. And his first response back to Deputy Slavin was, well, what do you think happened to her? Which was, you know, it's not a normal answer to a question of what do you know? And what Ed Hertel said during that very informal interview was, I worked last night. I never saw Nancy. I wasn't over at the inn. And that's kind of where it sat for a little bit that day.
Now, they had to investigate Cliff, obviously, people close to Nancy. So in pursuit of that, what do they find out about Cliff and the status of the relationship between him and Nancy? You write about what their plans were following this date in a couple weeks, what their plans were for both of them.
They were going to retire. They'd bought a motorhome and they were going to head south, get out of the Idaho winters and head south and spend a great winter in Arizona where it was warm. And this all came crashing together. And so, you know, even that morning, Bartolo was skookum enough to realize that you got to look in close before you start widening the circle. And he sat down with Cliff in the inn that morning and asked him if there was something going on and had Cliff explain this marriage where one's living at the inn and the other one's living up at the other lodge 7 miles away. And Cliff explained all that and Cliff agreed. If I have to take a polygraph, I don't have a problem with that. And Cliff promised Bartolo at that time there wasn't anything else amiss going on between the relationship.
Now, at the same time, he had a pretty good alibi in that he had a fellow, his brother-in-law, with him.
He had Nancy's brother that was staying with him. And so in order for Cliff to have committed this thing, Cliff would have had to snuck out of his place in the middle of the night, driven down there and did the dirty deed and got back home. And
Now, in terms of Ed Hertel, they have some information, and obviously what he says is his first statements. Now, they also find out how he comes to be in the area, and then Leo Nowak and his wife. So tell us how he ends up being there in the first place, and then the evolving story of Eddie Hertel.
Well, about 5 months prior to this incident, Leo Nowak and Ed Hertel and Nowak's family were living in Grand Junction, Colorado. And they met at this Christian Identity Movement, which, in my opinion, is an odd duck. What Christian Identity is those people believe that Adam and Eve had their offspring, but then Eve also had offspring from the serpent. And the offspring from Adam were the Aryan people, including Jesus Christ, and that the people derived from the serpent and Eve were what they would call mud people, blacks, Mexicans, anybody with any skin color. Right. And so it was a Christian Identity is a very extreme racist movement. That same concept is in the KKK and that sort of thing. And they're very into the second coming apocalyptic stuff. And along goes with that is malicious stuff. And in this Christian Identity movement that the Nowaks and Hertel were involved in, the witnesses that had been there, they characterize it as more of a militia than a religion. All of the males wore sidearms. So it was a strange mix. And Nowaks and Hertel moved to Idaho because the wrong kind of people were moving to Grand Junction, i.e. people of color.
Now, with this Nowak and his relationship with Eddie Hertel, the thing is he overhears a conversation that Eddie Hertel has with someone. And then from there, wants to take him to the sheriff. because he has heard Eddie utter a lie. Tell us about this occurrence.
Herc tells a friend that he was living on the same property with Leo Nowak, drove down to North Fork to find out what's going on. He finds that out that Eddie hadn't been working that night, and that it was obvious that he'd listened to Hertel lie to the deputy about what had gone on. So he goes home, grabs Hertel, brings him back to North Fork, the center of this activity, and brings him forth to Deputy Slavin and says, you got to tell Slavin the truth. So Deputy Slavin puts him in his truck and finds out now that Ed Hertel has changed his story and said, I didn't work last night. And yes, I was at the River's Fork Inn drinking margaritas until it closed. And then he drove around till 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, and read a book for a little while. And all during this storm that was just going crazy, it was 8 inches of fresh snow that night.
So how do they sort of trying to counter the police forensically? What kind of luck do they have in terms of the usual prints, hair, fiber, blood spatter, and searches of his vehicle? How do they progress with that? Any luck, any clues, any leads?
Well, that was a main major problem with that investigation, is there was, other than looking around the North Fork Inn, the River's Fork Inn, there was nothing really done. There was, you know, it wasn't locked down or anything like that. It was a major regret of the sheriff. And after that second interview where Slavin finds out that Hertel had been over at the inn, he grabs another deputy and they go up and they do a kind of a cursory look at Hertel's car and come up with more or less nothing other than some knives and a hatchet. But they didn't notice any blood or anything amiss or any other signs that the car had been associated with a crime.
Now, many of these stories that I've read and have featured on the program have involved people coming forward, and those namely being psychics. And as you write, the police are obliged to follow up the leads that would be generated from these, whatever the psychics report.
They absolutely are. And the reason they're obliged to follow up, whether they believe in any possibility of that paranormal or whatever, is that you don't know that a person doesn't call in and say, I know where her body is because I've had this vision. And in reality, they know where the body is because their husband told them where it is, or something along that line. But there were numerous psychics that called in, contacted the sheriff's office, and they chased them down. They had to chase them down.
Now tell our audience how you come to be involved inextricably in this case. What are the conditions and the situation where you find yourself tasked to go talk to Ed Hertel?
Well, on that morning, I was up chasing wildlife crime. I was up patrolling for elk hunters, looking for somebody that maybe had gone across the line and broken a law. And I keep hearing on the radio something about some activity at North Fork. And I originally thought it was probably a car wreck. And then I heard the word search come across my radio. So at that point in time, I thought it was a lost hunter, which made sense because of the storm. Mm-hmm. Hunters get lost in that country. And I always felt it was part of my job to go help with those searches. So I come off the mountain and come down to the local volunteer fire department where they set up a command post. And that's when I was told that Nancy Cummings, a person I knew, certainly knew Cliff Cummings, I knew that she was missing. In fact, I lived less than a mile away from where it happened. And that's when I sat down with Deputy Slavin and Brett Barcelow, and they requested my assistance.
So why did they think they thought you might have a rapport with them because you had spoke to them a couple of times. So tell us about the interaction itself.
Well, you know, as I've said, North Fork is an extremely small place. So I knew who Ed Hertel was. I knew who Leo Nowak was, even though they'd only been there 5 months. And a couple times while I'd been in the North Fork Cafe having breakfast or dinner or whatever it was, Ed Hertel, that worked there as a dishwasher and janitor, had approached me wearing my fish and game uniform. And on two different occasions, asked me the same question about recovering roadkill animals for food. And I gave him the same answer. At the time, it wasn't legal, and he didn't like the answer, but that was the way it was. And so Sheriff Barcelow and his deputy Slavin were just grasping at straws, and they were hoping I had some kind of rapport with this guy, which I didn't consider that I did. But they asked me to go interview the guy. And by this time, it was dark. And I grabbed a U.S. Forest Service officer and went over and found him. And he was in the kitchen at the time. We asked to talk to him, and he's got this big bag of garbage over his back, big garbage sack. So we go outside. He throws the garbage into this big open dumpster. And I told him that we were looking for information about Nancy, and she was missing and all that. And we'd heard he'd been over at the inn, and he instantly got defensive. I hadn't accused him of anything, far from it. Mm-hmm. And that set up a big red flag. And he got all nervous, and it just didn't make sense. Now, I didn't know this guy. I'd met him the two times. So I didn't know if this was a normal reaction he had with officers or what, but it just didn't make sense. And I kept trying to drag him back to, Ed, help us out here. You know, what was going on there? And he said there was a bunch of cowboys in there, and we're going along, and he keeps getting defensive, and he says, I didn't do nothing to her. Well, you know, we're not accusing him of any harm. And so I'm just really scratching my head on this thing. And I see some headlights bobbing in the background in the darkness. And pretty soon a gal brings a dog up, and the dog's got an orange vest on, and she's wearing an orange vest. And I knew they had search dogs, cadaver dogs, working out back along the river down there.
Right.
And the next thing I know, that cadaver dog came up, stuck his nose in Ed Hertel's crotch, and sat down. And I was just stunned, because I'd worked around a lot of drug dogs, but I'd never worked around a cadaver dog. And I was just so stunned, because I thought maybe this dog had just alerted on this guy. And then Hertel turns to me and says, these are the same clothes I had on last night. He looks away into the darkness. He looks back and says, and she touched my car, but she didn't get in.
Wow.
And then another dog handler comes up, talks to this first dog handler, puts his dog up there, and that dog does the same damn thing.
Wow.
Sticks his nose in Ed Hertel's crotch, sits down. And at some point in time in this conversation, Hertel blurted out this biblical thing about a pale horse. And I didn't understand what the heck that was until later. But in the Bible, there's some reference to death riding a pale horse. And I still scratch my head on all that. But so I'm getting basically nowhere with this interview other than his paranoia and his claims that he didn't do anything to this person that we don't know had been harmed. And I begin to realize that this guy knew a lot more about what had happened. That's my belief at this point in time, than what he was saying or what we knew. And the problem I had with this was a Miranda issue.
Right.
And Miranda comes into play when you've got two things going. Number one, you're questioning a suspect about a crime. And two, he feels he's in custody.
Right.
Now, under normal circumstances, in the back of outside a building like this, a court would not determine that this was a custodial environment. But the way the guy was acting, he just didn't seem all there. Didn't seem like his gears were quite meshing. You'd ask him a question, and there'd be a long pause. And it wasn't like he was trying to make up an answer. I think his things just weren't clicking for him. So I seriously doubted whether he had a normal IQ. And I realized that I felt that as if we got any real inculpatory statement from him, that he admitted to it or confessed or whatever, it wouldn't hold up in court. And I realized that if I read him his Miranda right there and he didn't understand his Miranda, again, whatever he said would not hold up in court. So I backed off. And that's one of my career regrets, is not reaching into his guts and pulling a confession out, because the guy was with, author John Perry, he thought Hertel was about ready to confess. And so instead, I walked away. And that's one of my career regrets. It was a tough thing to do.
So you decide to go get Chief Deputy Slavin and let him handle it. So how does he handle Ed Hertel?
Well, we went back and briefed Barcelo and Slavin about this whole thing. And the next day, they still focused on trying to find the body. I mean, they definitely thought Hertel was as culpable as I thought he was.
Right.
And within a few days, they brought in Idaho State Police Bureau of Investigations to do a polygraph on Hertel. And during that interview, Hertel became so nervous, a polygraph wasn't going to work. He got too emotional. At one point in time, he went in the bathroom near where this interview was taking place and started throwing up. He was that disturbed. And when he finally came back in, the detective, Stimson, asked him, "Well, Ed, tell me what you think happened here." And after a long time, maybe a minute, he came up with his story that he'd been driving on the highway, and he looked over at the North Fork Inn, the Rivers Fork Inn, and he saw Cliff's truck backed up to this door, 90 degrees to his view, and saw Cliff pulling her body into the pickup truck wrapped in a sheet. So the whole investigation shifted at that point in time.
Yeah, it does. You write, though, that there is another interview, the fourth interview. And again, it looks very, very promising. In fact, they think, again, that he's ready to confess. And then his sister comes in. And then what happens?
Yeah, so that was done the day before this polygraph had been set up. And that was with Deputy Nan Colas, a female officer. And Barcelow felt that maybe he'd be more willing to talk to a female officer. And things were going real good there on that thing. Wasn't getting in a lot of different information. But she got him to talk about where he'd driven that night and several other details. And then his sister shows up from Colorado, wants to talk to Ed. They talk in there for a bit. Then she comes out and says, "Ed needs to talk to you about something." And the deputy thought, well, maybe this is it. Maybe he's going to give it up. Well, she walks in and Ed says, "I want an attorney." So right there, that interview was done.
Yeah. Now, this is November 21st. You talk about a John Stauffer. He's camping at Newland Ranch site about 3/4 of a mile from North Fork Inn.
Yes.
Tell us what happens, what he discovers.
Ironically, we call that neck of the woods down there dead water.
Mm-hmm.
But he was camped down there. He and his friend were doing a little trapping in the area, and he decides he wants to walk back to North Fork, 1/4 mile, whatever it is, to call his wife, let her know what's going on. And he's walking on the road, so more or less a county type road, Forest Service road. But he's walking along, and it's dark. And a vehicle comes driving by and starts to night blind him. So he looks away, and the headlights flash on something pink in the rocks. And so Stauffer walks over, lets his night vision come back. It looks like there's something covered in rocks there. And so as the light comes back, and this is the day after a full 2 weeks into a full moon, he picks up a rock, and there it is, a woman's foot with a sock on it. Now, you know, a small town like this, John Stauffer knew exactly who he was looking at, but he just couldn't accept that he was looking at a frozen, dead body. And after a while, and we'll never know because he doesn't know, he said he stood there for a long time, staring with his mouth agape. He took off at a dead run and ran to the nearest building, which is a Forest Service residence about 1/4 of a mile away, knocked on the door. You know, here it is, dark outside, it's cold. Knocks on this door, and the Forest Service ranger opens the door, sees this wild, crazy-looking guy that's all upset. He's almost yelling. And John Stauffer yells at the ranger, "I found her." The ranger knew exactly what he was talking about. He knew that he'd found Nancy's body. So they jump in the car, run down there, and then they stand there and stare at this makeshift grave for who knows how long, just letting it just kind of soak into their souls. Then they drove back, called the sheriff's office, and as much as is available in Lemhi County, rolls out there. Slavin rolled out there, the sheriff, another deputy, and dispatch called me up to go assist. And we got out there and started doing what we needed to do.
Do police gain any knowledge forensically from the finding of Nancy's body? And if not, how do they proceed in investigating their main suspect, Ed Hertel?
Well, that night, what was done was mainly just photographic evidence. You know, after each rock was picked up, Barcelo would take 2 separate cameras to make sure. That was back in the days of film, to make sure that they got it. Each time he'd pick a rock up, he'd grab both cameras and take pictures until she was fully uncovered. And she was only just covered with big rocks. And once that happened, we put her in a body bag and sent her away with a coroner. And the next day, she was shipped off to do an autopsy in Pocatello, 3 hours away. And the Idaho State Police investigators came up. And at that point in time, this is 2 weeks after the murder, did a comprehensive forensic search of the River's Fork Inn. And the only thing that was found on Nancy's body, she was wearing a pink nightgown. She was wearing socks that were pulled down. And she had a watch on that was still running. She had a silver cross around her neck. She still had that wedding ring that Cliff had given her 57 years ago. And she was missing her panties. And her daughter said she always wore panties except when she was taking a bath. So that was a real suspect thing. And then at the River's Fork Inn, the scene was clean. It had literally been cleaned by relatives of Nancy. And, you know, like in hindsight, it just digs on Barcelo that they didn't lock that thing down that first morning. But in reality, even if you pulled the CSI crew out of the TV show, put it in the inn that morning, even if you come up with Hertel's fingerprints, even if you'd come up, you know, this is pretty much pre-DNA, even if you had his DNA there, all it would prove is he was there and that was already a known. So forensically, there was nothing. Now, in the autopsy, they did recover a hair.
Let's talk about Eddie Hertel's past, and especially his history in mental institutions. And also, police talk to a person named Britt, and Britt tells them a few things that he claims that Ed Hertel mentioned that are a very big interest to police considering.
Yeah, so Ed Hertel had been in and out of mental institutions. It seemed like every time he did something bad, he'd get stuck in a mental institution. He'd try to commit suicide, then he'd get stuck in a mental institution for a little while. He'd been in and out of those things. But one of his coworkers, this Brit, that he worked the same shift with her, she was a cook, he was the janitor, do-all laborer type. And Hertel thought that she was an American Indian, and she wasn't, but it doesn't make any difference. She still had dark hair. Her skin was a little dark, and he was suspicious that she was a minority. Mm-hmm. And several times she caught him to where she thought he was stalking her. He hated Jews. He hated Blacks, anybody of color. So the other thing that Britt caught him doing one night, she went outside, and here's Eddie Hertel with a cat under his arm, and he's strangling the cat. She confronts him. She's upset. "What are you doing, Ed?" And he says, "I'm just giving it a little love." And so that's kind of Ed Hertel right there. He admitted to Britt that during a full moon, he did weird things. Well, the night Nancy disappeared, it was a full moon.
Now, he moves back to Grand Junction, and he's in and out of mental institutions. Tell us on the circumstances in which the police feel that they have to make a move. He's in the institution, and how they do this.
So there was a real concern that Hertel was going to disappear into the wind, just like the dark side of the moon. He was going to disappear. I mean, he owned very little. He had a house he'd bought for $8,000 2 years after he graduated from high school, which I thought was rather amazing. Mm-hmm. But he had that. But other than that, he really didn't have much. And he'd sold that before he'd moved to Idaho So he had his car, and they felt that as the heat started to come on, and I get the sense that he knew the heat was coming on, he was just going to disappear. But he'd try to commit suicide by drinking, if I recall, a pint of vodka and some aspirin. And so he was put in on a mental hold, and they were concerned that as soon as he got out of that thing, he was going to flee. And so they managed to get a warrant for his arrest for second-degree murder. And they were planning to pick him up the day he walked out of that thing. But unfortunately, he walked out and disappeared. And for 3 days, the Grand Junction police searched for him. And finally, they found him at his dad's place.
And he was arrested.
He was arrested, and he was held there for a couple of weeks and refused extradition. And then there was a governor's warrant. And after 2 or 3 weeks, he was flown to Salmon, Idaho.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear about our sponsor, which is Talkspace. It's time for the annual spring clean around our home. Time to clean up the yard, clean up the shed, get ready for people to come and visit. It's just as important to take care of the mental space you're dwelling in. Over the years, adverse thoughts and emotions can build up. That's why it's so important to talk to a trained professional to help declutter your mental space. What's great about Talkspace is their unique approach to therapy with support from a licensed therapist absolutely anytime you need help. Talkspace relieves much of that pressure to get started, making appointments flexible and affordable. They have thousands of therapists across dozens of specialties. Once you match with your therapist, you can contact them anytime from anywhere with 24/7 text, audio, and video messaging. If thoughts and emotions are piling up, a fresh perspective can help you feel better. Match with your dedicated therapist today. Sign up to get $100 off your first month at Talkspace.com and use promo code TRUEMURDER and get $100 off your first month. That's $100 off at Talkspace.com, promo code TRUEMURDER. Now, Tony, we were talking about things leading up to the preliminary and to the inevitable trial. Tell us about the characters in terms of prosecution and defense and a little bit about anticipation for this in terms of what kind of case this actually was.
It was pretty clear that this case was marginal at best. It was an entirely circumstantial case, but there were three evidentiary items that held some hope. When the state police went back to the death scene where the body had been hidden, they found two different things there. They found a pair of Bolle sunglasses laying nearby. They also found a photograph of a Civil War era cannon, I think reproduction cannon, laying there. And they found that hair that I mentioned during the autopsy. And so the first big issue was, what is that hair? Whose hair was that? And Barcelo was hoping that would be the key to the golden goose, something that tied her tail to the body. And so that was forensically examined. And before that, they went ahead and got a judge's order to take hair from her tail. And so it was a forensic comparison then. And the first thing they compared that mystery hair to was Nancy's hair. And that came back negative. It didn't match. And then they examined that hair with hair that was taken from various places, including pubic hair, from her tail. And it came back negative again. And so that had no evidentiary value. And so the big thing was the photograph and this Bolle sunglasses. And of course, they were dusted for prints. The only thing on there were smudges. And Barcelo felt that both items had fallen out of Hertel's car when he dumped the body. I believe that's true. And Hertel, he was really into guns and that sort of thing. He'd been previously arrested for possession of explosives, and he had quite a bit of black powder and safety fuse maybe 5 years before he moved to Idaho. And he said during that investigation that he used the black powder and cannon for a black powder and fuse for a cannon he owned, but he'd blown the cannon up and hauled it to dump. And so Barcelo and the state investigators really looked hard trying to connect that photograph to her tail. There were interviews done by the Grand Junction Police Department with cannon people in Grand Junction, seeing if they'd ever had contact with her tail and a cannon, if this was her tail's cannon. They showed that photograph to his coworkers, hoping that her tail had shown them the cannon he once owned. Unfortunately, they came up with nothing. Nobody had seen that photograph. Nobody in Grand Junction had seen Hertel's cannon. So that there they were. They're sitting there with absolutely no physical evidence.
So they proceed to trial and they attempt to at least negate the defense, which tries to point the finger at Cliff and his sons at least. And they try to obviously attribute it that he has not the mental capacity to be able to have done this. So what are the defining factors and what happens in terms of verdict?
Well, obviously, Hertel's attorney, which coincidentally is the same attorney that's representing Lori Daybell in the murder of her two kids.
Interesting.
He made the big push that Hertel was not adept to understand Miranda when it was done by Stimson and the female deputy, and that none of that stuff should have been put in play. And he made the push that since I hadn't Mirandized him, any of his statements during that contact with canine dogs shouldn't be allowed into court. And the judge assigned two different psychologists to examine him, and both agreed that Hertel was intelligent enough to understand Miranda, intelligent enough to read Miranda and understand it. And so his mental capacity at that point in time was not a legal issue, which kind of grabs back at my guts for not pushing him into saying something inculpatory that dark night on the back steps of the North Fork Cafe. Anyway, his attorney definitely did go after Cliff just to give the jury just a little bit of doubt that perhaps Cliff killed his own wife. And it was not a happy time for Cliff. And so the jury was only out for 2 hours. And there was no question in my mind what they were going to find. They found him not guilty. And he walked out of the courtroom that day.
So you say it really divided the community. And obviously no closure for anyone. And you write about worrying about Cliff being so close to Eddie Hertel in that courtroom and what he might do, because he did have an outburst in court testifying at one point. What does Eddie Hertel do? Where does he go? And what happens next in this story?
Well, Hertel left with his sister back to Grand Junction that day. And went back to his same old ways. He went back to his Christian Identity Movement people, his militia contacts back there. And in that movement, he'd known of a woman by the name of Jerry McAvee. And Jerry had heard he'd been arrested in Idaho, and she had that group pray for him during his trial. Must have worked. So he and Jerry start some kind of friendly relationship that slowly turned into a romantic relationship. And 5 months after he walked out of that courtroom in Idaho, Jerry turned up missing. And Grand Junction Police Department opened a missing person case. And within 3 days, they realized it was something much worse than a missing person, that Jerry McAvee just hadn't gone on vacation. And they opened up a homicide investigation, even though there again, they didn't have a body.
Tell us what some of the things that in this investigation they find are commonalities, interestingly enough, between McAvee and Ed Hertel.
Well, both women, Nancy Cummings, Jerry McAvee, were older. In fact, even though Jerry wasn't as old as Nancy, they looked the same. They both wore glasses with chains, mm-hmm. like a librarian, and they both looked about the same age. They both looked to be in their 50s, and they were both about the same size. And obviously, Hertel was attracted to Nancy Cummings. He had the hots for her. That's what he told several people, which is an odd thing to have a hots for somebody that's 30 years your elder. And then even with Jerry McAvee, she was 20 years his elder. And somewhere in the mix of that, he ran into his old babysitter that was 10 years older than him, that way back when he was 10 years old, he'd had a sexual relationship with. You know, somebody might call that an affair, but it was legally, it was non-consensual rape. That only went on for some time. That's what caused him to have he even admitted it. That's what caused him to have his sexual interest in older women. That's what he was attracted to. And both Nancy that's what he went to the Rivers Fork Inn that night, was to have sex with Nancy. And of course, she shut him down. And that's why he killed her, in my humble opinion. And then with Jerry, he had this relationship. And the belief is that day, on the 14th of April, I believe it was, she shut him down and says, "I don't want to see you anymore." And that's when he killed her. And that's why this is a chronicle of an unrequited killer.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, let's talk about the investigation to bring him to justice over this McAvee, this woman he killed. Tell us what happens and the arrest.
Well, the Grand Junction Police Department is quite the opposite of the Lemhi County Sheriff's Office. Grand Junction has a serious investigative branch. They have a serious forensic branch. They do a lot of murders. And the lead investigator was a guy named George Barley. And George starts focusing in on Hertel within about 3 days. He came up with Hertel's name, phone number in a diary or a notebook of Jerry McAfee's. That was the first flag. And he well knew of Hertel's history in Idaho, and he well knew that Sheriff Barcelo, without a doubt, still believed, even though he'd been found not guilty, had killed Nancy Cummings. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge red flag for Barley. The other thing that they found in McAfee's house was a hand mirror, an antique hand mirror. And it turned out that mirror had Hertel's fingerprints on it. So they start watching Hertel's house, and they realize that at one point in time, I think it was day three of Jerry being missing, Jerry calls her sister up and starts asking questions that didn't sound right. They had planned an acupuncture session together, and Jerry is asking when and where, and her sister knew that she knew these questions that didn't need to be answered. And in the background, she heard some kids playing outside. And so Barley early on recognized the fact that at Hertel's house that his dad owned, there was right next to a school across the street with a yard where the kids played. And so the focus starts going in on Hertel. And within two weeks, they located Jerry's car within a few blocks of Hertel's house. Now, they never did come up with Hertel's fingerprints in that car, but Jerry had been a meticulous records keeper, and she documented when she filled up for gas and the mileage, and it was right before she went over to Ed Hertel's house. The mileage said that anyway. And then the mileage log showed that you could drive that car to Ed Hertel's house and then over to where it was dumped. And so that was a significant part in this investigation.
So they realize they have a guy that may be a safety risk, and he's staying with his grandma. So they devise a way to safely be able to execute this arrest. Tell us about that. And again, the journey.
They knew that Ed Hertel had said that if two or more officers show up my door, there'll be gunplay, something that effect. He was living in this duplex of his dad owned, and this neighbor, the guy living in the other side of the duplex, kept smelling something bad, something rotting. And he confronted Ed with that. And Ed said some cats had died in the crawl space and he did clean them up, which, of course, the smell never went away. That was another big thing about what was going on here. But Hertel was heavy into guns. He had thousands of rounds of ammunition. He'd been investigated in a pipe bombing thing. I mentioned that with that cannon thing, and he'd charged with explosives. And so they were concerned that he had bombs in that house. They were concerned that he'd have a weapon on him and that sort of thing. So they wanted to get him stopped and somewhat in custody, or at least question him at that point in time before they hit the house with a search warrant. They had a search warrant for the house and they had one for his car. And so Detective Barley and another detective set up on his mother's house because they knew, they were aware that he was staying with his mother. She was sick. And finally, at 11 o'clock that morning, Hertel gets in his car, drives by them, and gives them the nod, recognized that he was being watched. It was an unmarked car. They were not in uniform, but he was that pinked up. And they finally got him pulled over, and he jumped out of his car. They get out of their car. He didn't have any weapons. And they told him what was going on. There was a search warrant going on at his house. They were impounding his car for a search warrant, and he never asked them what they were looking for.
Mm-hmm. Now you have him getting ready for trial here, and the preliminary is there's enough evidence to obviously proceed to trial. While he's in custody during the preliminary, an interesting exchange happens based on the idea that they feel he may be suicidal. So they call a nurse, Kathy, and she is concerned for her safety. So she has an officer accompany them, and she has an interview with Hertel. Tell us about this crucial conversation.
Absolutely. And so let me step back for a minute. At that search warrant, they find Jerry McAfee's body under that house in the crawl space, rotting away, buried in about a foot of dirt. And so in a sense, there's the smoking gun. It's yes. Hard to explain your dead girlfriend's body in your house. And so that was the big deal. Now, he was arrested that night on first degree murder. And at some point in time, he got wigged out. And one of the correctional officers was worried that he was a suicidal risk. So he brought in a nurse to interview him. And she was very afraid to be with this accused murderer in the same room. And so she asked for a deputy to step in. So the deputy's standing nearby. I'm sure he had his arms crossed. I'm sure he's watching this guy for any movement. And Ed Hertel says, "I killed my girlfriend. I killed Jerry McAvee." Now, the interview between the nurse and Hertel would be privileged information. That nurse could not testify. But with the deputy overhearing that confession, that was admissible. So Ed Hertel was facing the death penalty in Colorado. And it was a case made out of steel, as I put it in the book. Here's this rotting body under the floorboards. Here's this confession in front of a correctional officer. And at one point in time, his attorney in Colorado tried to point the finger at Nancy Cummings' sons that went over there, killed Jerry McAvee, and put the body under his house to frame him, which was, I'm sure that the steam coming out of that magic bottle drifted in the wind rather quickly. But so anyway, there it was. And once again, Hertel's attorney tried to use the insanity defense, and under Colorado, it did not work. And so eventually, Ed Hertel pled guilty to second-degree murder.
What was the sentence for him? And as you write, when's his mandatory release date?
The sentence was the maximum. The judge gave him 40 years, the maximum for a second-degree homicide. And she mentioned how dangerous he was in society, to society, and mentioned how much he hated blacks and Jews as part of that sentence. And so he got that 40 years. He'll be out in 2037. He'll be 70 years old.
He was asked, you write, just interestingly, why he killed Jerry and his reasoning for that.
He justified it to that nurse that the cops were always putting the heat on him, and they kind of were. Nothing unjustly, but he blamed it on the cops. That's why he killed Jerry McAvee. He's never, to my knowledge, admitted to killing Nancy Cummings. You know, there was an alleged jailhouse confession here in Salmon while he was being held here, but I don't put much weight in that. It could have been happened. It could have just been another convict trying to get some kind of reduced sentence for coming up with a story. But I think he doesn't even want to admit to himself that he killed Nancy Cummings.
Yeah. You write in the epilogue before the end, you write that you did about 50 interviews and you attempted to speak to Ed Hertel. You wished you would have been able to speak to Cliff. Just tell us about some of the people that you would have liked to have spoken to and the most profound things that you heard during this entire project.
Well, I spoke to Nancy and Cliff's kids, and that really grabbed at me because, you know, this murder happened 27 years ago. And here I'm talking to adult people that males are not supposed to be too emotional, 27 years after the fact, and one of them's crying, the other one's trying to hold back from crying. And to this day, it just bothers them deeply. And it really struck me that there's no box to put the fact that your mother, your wife, your grandmother was murdered over sex or lack of sex and dumped beside a road and covered in rocks. To this day, those people, it really grinds on them that it happened. I mean, it's been eating them for decades. And I would have loved to have Ed Hertel's father talk to me, but he's deceased. And I doubt he would have talked to me. He didn't believe Ed had killed Nancy Cummings. And then on the night of the search warrant at 10 o'clock at night, he turns the news on and sees that Jerry McAvee's body has been found in the crawl space of his house where his kid is living. And he drove over to the guy still working the scene and said, "He had me fooled." So in all these interviews, there was 46 interviews. Some of them were really gut-wrenching stories. You know, a murder just doesn't, as I say, doesn't end at sentencing. That murder story just goes on and just eats at people. In North Fork, Idaho, to this day, the place has not been the same. There hasn't been another murder in 27 years. People lock their doors. People have pistols sitting beside their beds. And it's all because of Ed Hertel and the killing of Nancy Cummings.
Yes. I want to thank you very much, Tony H. Latham, for coming on and talking about Under a Cold Moon, a chronicle of an unrequited killer. It's been fascinating. For those that might want to take a look at more information, is there somewhere where they might take a look and tell us when this book was released?
It was published last month in May, and it's available in the Amazon jungle, of course, both in print and Kindle. And sometime by this fall, I'll have it as an audiobook, and I'm going to go ahead and narrate this one myself.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you very much, Tony H. Latham, Under a Cold Moon, a Chronicle of an Unrequited Killer. Thank you very much, and you have a great evening. Good night.
Thanks so much, Dan, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Good night.